2019. Your membership donation is tax deductible and the best way to show you believe in our work and the importance of a free, food-focused media resource. Consider donating today at heritageradionetwork.org by clicking the donate button. Thanks for your support and enjoy the show.
This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. I'm coming to you from snowy Essex, New York. We have a house full of greenhorns and much project making here going on. And I'm joined today on the phone by Michael from Bean Farm in Minnesota. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Sorry, it's Easy Bean Farm.
Yeah.
That's a crazy name, Michael. How did you choose your name?
Well, it's actually an incredibly silly story. When we started our farm, I started this farm with two friends in 1996, and we were headed to the Organic Growers Conference in Wisconsin, and we felt like we needed to have a name, otherwise no one was going to take us seriously, as if anyone would take us seriously anyway. And we were kind of fighting over what we were going to name our farm. We had these very earthy-sounding names, and then Kermit the Frog came on the radio, or the tape, I guess. I think it was a tape, singing "It's Not Easy Being Green." And I'm not sure. I don't remember that final step, how we went from that to our name being Easy Bean. But somehow we did it, and then we thought it was temporary. And then, you know, perhaps 3 or 4 years later, I thought, oh, it's so silly, it's so goofy, we should really change it. And but then everybody we talked to said, no, it's distinctive, we remember it. So here we are 17 years later, still with the same goofy name.
Well, it just goes to show, you know, there's almost like a kind of a chronology now, the different phases of farm naming periods. And then
yeah.
There's just like, there's only so many blue heron farms that you can have, number one.
Yeah,
and
it's silly, and it's actually funny. We get calls, because we're listed in various organic directories, we get calls, international calls, from all over looking for distributors of edible soybeans. I mean, we've had many things like that where people are constantly calling us for things that we don't do just because our name has got the word bean in it. And, of course, there's nothing easy about growing beans anyway, so it's a really dumb name, but whatever.
So do you grow beans?
We do. I mean, it's one of the, you know, maybe 70-something crops we grow, but they grow well. It's the picking, of course, that is. I guess they're easy to grow. They're just that keeping them picked is always a challenge. To get our crew becomes less and less motivated as the weeks go by to pick beans. So
give us a tiny little sketch out of your operation and of your kind of landscape context.
Okay.
In terms of crops, ecology, and social world
sure.
For your farm.
Okay, well, our farm is located way, way out in a deep rural setting, I would say. We're about 140 miles west of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We're in the glaciated area of Minnesota, so this is formerly prairie. There's still a few remnants of prairie. Our farm is 120 acres and sits in a river valley. It's sort of bisected by the Chippewa River, which feeds into the Minnesota, which then just south of here feeds into the Mississippi. So we have largely kind of sandy alluvial soil, sandy and silty alluvial soils on the farm. We're, for our area, our farm has a landscape that's not that typical. It's a little more rolly, and of course it's more wooded being in the river valley. We're surrounded by, you know, very, very large corn and soybean, largely operations. There's some sugar beet. But, you know, this is sort of, this when people talk about the breadbasket, this is it right around here. You know, I think the average farm size in our county sits close to 1,000 acres at this point, or 800 acres, I can't remember, something in that range. So we have on our 120 acres, we've done about 29 acres of tree planting. since we got here in 1996. We've done some prairie restoration work. We have about 16 acres that we have in our vegetable rotation. We have about 42 acres that are part of a rotational grazing system, which also we have tree plantings on with the idea of doing some silvopastoral stuff. And, but the our farm, the Easy Bean Farm part of our farm, is largely a CSA. We have about a 280-share CSA. I don't know. What else can I say? We grow this sort of a very wide range of crops. Pretty much everything that we can think of growing, we try to grow at least, that grows well in the upper Midwest here. And then, we do a little bit of this and that besides the vegetables. So we have some chickens, and we've raised cattle, and this and that. So,
holy smokes, you guys are doing so many things.
Yeah, well, we've actually pared down. We had the typical new farmer. This is now many years back, but we had the new farmer thing of wanting to do everything. So we had dairy goats, and we had, we've done it all, I think, and not very successfully sometimes. But then at a certain point, really wanted to focus on getting to be a reasonably good vegetable grower, and so we sort of pared back. And so, like I said, probably 95% of our income comes from the vegetables, and of that, the bulk of that comes through our CSA. We do some wholesale and direct sale, and we do quite a bit of stuff that goes to food shelves in the cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, but the CSA is really the sort of bread and butter for our farm.
The CSA bread and butter.
Yes.
And explain a little bit from the context of, I think it's a really important set of notions to get concretely into the minds of young farmers who are thinking about the trade-off of, tiny little parcels that are overpriced, that are close in
right.
suburban markets versus, much more affordable land, but further out in the country with, less accessible schools and services, more degraded rural economy or more commodity-oriented economy. Could you,
sure.
Explain a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I think about and I talk with people about. I mean, we did it sort of accidentally. I wish I could say that when we started our farm, I had, really thoroughly thought out the move. But in fact, this was the opportunity, and so I came here. I was in my early 20s. But as far as the trade-offs are concerned, when we bought our property, we were able to buy our land for under $500 an acre at the time, which gave us a lot of flexibility. It's something that I see that happens a lot with young farmers. We see it a lot. Minnesota's had an explosion of CSA farms and small vegetable farms and is that, similarly, people want to stay, obviously, for transportation reasons, within that, 40 miles of a large metropolitan area, and not just for transportation issues, but the land values here can be as high as $10,000 an acre. And so what I see happens is people buy, you want to buy enough land that your business can grow, because obviously, you can't just buy for what you're ready to farm immediately if you're getting started. And so the amount of money that people have to sink into their land and then the interest payments on that, especially on land that's not going to be productive for several years, then forces a set of decision-making that isn't necessarily in the best interest of the farm. I've seen a lot of people ramp up very, very, very quickly, really too quickly, and make mistakes because they have this pressure of a very expensive mortgage. And so for us, the cheapness of the place that we live and of the taxes and whatnot allowed us, gave us, and again, it was inadvertent. I didn't plan it. I just got lucky. But it gave us a lot of room to screw things up and to move really, really slowly in building our business, in taking some of the pressure off for feeling like it had to make a lot of money very quickly. And I think that's good as you're learning and learning about what pieces of land, what parts of your farm are really good bits of farmland that are going to be highly productive or can take, you know, various cultivation techniques. And for me, there's all been all of these added bonuses that I didn't really expect. I mean, I moved out here in my early 20s, and I came from I grew up 2.5 miles outside of New York City in northern New Jersey. And so for me, the adventure of living, it was, you know, there are few places that are as different from Teaneck, New Jersey as Milan, Minnesota, in the United States at least. And so for me, the adventure of living in a place that was really different from what I grew up with was some of the attraction. And, you know, there are other benefits to living in a deeply rural area. There's lots of infrastructure that's not being used. And we have an aging population, so people are really looking for anybody who wants to move in and live in the area and take over all these institutions that were built, you know, both 2 generations and 3 generations back. And so that's nice. I feel like the work I do here doesn't get lost in the mix. I feel like it's greatly appreciated, and so I guess that's another bonus. And then, you know, for me, I've learned to just love the quietness of it. It's a really quiet place. I was just back in New York last week, and I thought, oh, it's so much quieter here. So.
Well, I a lot of the points that you're making really, really jive with some of the conversations and deliberations that I've been having with various farmers in various stages of their decision-making process and my own process. And I, you know, another kind of point that I wanted to just hear your view on is around those institutions that kind of still exist in rural areas,
mm-hmm.
and how appropriately scaled some of them are for the kind of work, the kind of coordinating work that needs to happen in this framework of re-regionalizing.
Right. I think that one of the things is that there are very, very strong networks that are already in place here, and they're familial networks, and they're church-based, and they're the things that have been going on in rural America for the last, you know, several hundred years. But they're smaller. You know, they're there and they're strong and they're degraded probably from where they were 50 years ago, obviously, but they're there. And so if a person is willing to take the time and say, you know, I care, I'm moving into this community, I love this community, I'm going to be here. I mean, I think people are suspicious of you at first and feel like, well, you know, who's this newcomer and what are they going to do to, you know. But then I think once you're in, things happen really smoothly, and the scale is very manageable. Like it, the number of people that you have to convince to have something happen. I mean, if you're someone who likes to make change, the number of people in a rural community that you have to convince is very, very small. There are very few people that are engaged in decision making in general out here, and so it. If you're willing to put in the energy and you're willing to be one of the people who shows up, you know, whether that be on the school board or in any other way, I think people are excited to see a young person come and want to steward this thing that means a lot to them. You know, once they get over their suspicion about you as an outsider. And so, yeah, I find it very nice. I mean, I find it to be one of those things where you can make a lot of change really quickly. I mean, you don't want to usually, but you can. It's there and it's waiting for people, and we need it. I mean, I live here. I think I had all sorts of notions growing up in a city about what rural areas, you know, deeply rural areas, particularly in the Midwest, were like. And most of the thoughts I had were negative, that this was a very backwards place, and the typical stereotypes. And of course, living here, it's not that way at all. It's like anywhere else. There's people trying to figure out how to feed their families and live good lives and pass on the things that are meaningful to them to the next generation and not see it wasted. I mean, I think that's when I talk to elders in this area. I think that there's a deep sadness about the idea that these things that they built aren't going to be used by anybody. And there's lots of people that would love to use them. I mean, I would hope so.
Well, I feel like you're pointing the way really productively and constructively around some kind of common themes or some, what do they call it, common ground, some places where you know, whatever political differences or commodity differences we might have, there's, you know, opportunity to come together. And I wondered if you have anything that you wanted to say. I mean, or I guess here's a proposition. Do you feel like the in these conversations about succession and the way that land moves forward, either intergenerationally or to newcomers, or in many cases what's happened and has continued to happen and is continuing to happen is more concentration of land ownership and absentee ownership. Do you feel like the theme of local control and local business is a powerful and usable platform for conversations about land and or what are the frames that you would recommend for younger people who are coming into communities and trying to engage, you know, respectfully, but to have a place of common ground for communication about the destiny of the farm, land, and farm ownership matrix within a community?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that one thing is that it takes time to even begin the dialogue with people, that if you come from the outside and you're full of ideas, as I was and most people are who you know, move, in, you know, are on this little adventure here, that I think what people, before people are willing to listen to you, they need to feel like you're not going to be dangerous to them in their community. And so part of that is being there. I feel like we continue perhaps in the minds of many people out here to be the weirdos, but now we're their weirdos. And we're not the weirdos, we're their weirdos. And so, and we've been here, and our kids are in school, and, you know, we volunteer with various organizations, and we show up, we consistently show up for things. And so I think that people are less afraid of engaging in the conversation if they feel like, oh, yeah, this person actually has a vested interest in what is good for this community, not what is just going to be good for them in the short run. And so, yes, I think that that conversation is good. I think there's a whole generation of aging farmers who get that, you know, our community can't survive. I mean, that if we keep consolidating farmland, there's just nobody here. I mean, you know, you look at the main streets in all these little towns. Montevideo, which is the bigger town that we live near, you know, has probably 25% of the storefronts are you know, underutilized or non-utilized at this point. I mean, we don't have a bookstore anymore. We don't have a bakery anymore. We don't have some of these really kind of foundational things because there just aren't enough people to support, you know, to support those things. And I think that people know that. I think there's that older generation that knows it. And I do think that talking about that, you can open up that dialogue. And we see it happening around here. We see lots of people that are reaching out to young farmers or people that want to farm and saying, you know, I've got a couple acres here. I've got this abandoned farm site. You know, you want to try doing something on it? And I think the payoff for them is that idea that someone will be there to take care of their, you know, the place that was their home for the last, whatever, 80 years or 75 years of their life. But I think that, again, moving into a rural community, a lot of it is about first showing people that you're serious. Before you begin engaging in the conversation, show them that you care about the things that they care about. And once you do that, I think they're going to be more likely to engage. I think, well, now I care about what you care about as well. What do you care about? But I think you have to first build those connections. I've definitely seen that here.
Well, yeah, okay, so this is really useful. I mean, these are great general themes that we keep working around and through, but I think, you know, to take it one level more specific, that if you're looking at your prospects as a 27-year-old or 25-year-old, and you've worked on a bunch of farms, and you haven't got any money, and you don't, you know, you barely have a car,
right?
And you're thinking, wow, this is really, I mean, the only way I'm going to be able to do this is through the gift economy or being really rural. That it would maybe make sense to also prepare professionally for the kinds of skills that are really needed in rural communities.
Sure, absolutely.
Be that nursing and, or chimney sweeping or
I mean, there's everything. I mean, we've got lots of nursing homes. We're ready. We're always hiring nurses out here. Absolutely. I mean, I think, and then, I mean, it's not for everybody. We certainly have had over the last 17 years people that have moved out here and just sort of felt like, they perhaps felt isolated or, I mean, one of the things that I have found really pleasurable living here is that it's forced me out of a lot of my comfort zones. So I think when I lived in the cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, or when I grew up, I tended to surround myself largely with people who thought like me, and, you know, sort of generally speaking. And there, you could do that. There's enough people that you can really surround yourself with. You can put yourself into a great little echo chamber, and it feels good, sort of. But what I really have liked is there's just not enough people to do that out here. And that goes in a lot of different ways. So, like, we have friends that are in their 90s, and I have friends that are 13. I don't think that I would have as wide a range of friendships in various ages if I didn't live out here. We're really forced to. I have friends that are very, very right on the political spectrum. And I, when I say friends, I actually mean they're friends. They're people that I love. And I have, you know, I would say we're probably around all the way out on the left out here, although there might be somebody further out. But that sort of forced me to move outside of my comfort zone and to talk to people about things and to listen to people tell me about the things that they care about that, you know, to me seem crazy, you know, but you have to. If we're going to be building community, you have to start with where people are at. As opposed to where you want them to be. And so, again, for living in a rural area, I mean, it's not for everybody, but I think once you get past that, if you see these limitations as assets, so another, like, little funny thing is, like, I learned how to bake bagels, and I never would have learned to bake bagels. This is really tangential, but if I didn't live out here, I grew up a Jew in New York eating bagels, and there aren't bagels. I mean, I could get like some crappy bagel at the grocery store in a bag, but so it's the same thing. That sort of is widespread. So you have to, if you want to live in a deeply rural area, you have to sort of like the idea of constraining yourself. You on Friday night, you can't pick the 50 different things you could go out and, you know, the plays and the bands you could go see and the art house movies and whatnot. That's just not there. But, you know, you can do anything. You make something to do among you and your friends. And so that's another aspect of it. I think it's really for people that want to explore a little more deeply, maybe, you know, what they're capable of. So, I don't know.
Well, and slash, if you make it compelling enough, if you're at it long enough, if the thing happens well enough, there's likely to be this, you know, at least in the place I live, there's all these civic institutions and facilities that could be re-inhabited with that kind of social programming.
And then there's all sorts of crazy stuff that's going on in rural America that you just don't hear about. So, like, we have a little town, Milan, near the closest town, spelled like Milan, and, you know, town of 500, Scandinavian, you know, largely Norwegian, a little bit of Swedish heritage. Really, like, they're known for that. They've got big Norwegian or Scandinavian pride. But I think 40% now of Milan are people who come from one island in Micronesia, this island of Chuk, And so you walk down Main Street, Milan, Minnesota, which is this little town, teeny little town, and there are islanders in beautiful floral skirts and flip-flops, and you can go to the little grocery store, teeny little grocery store, and you can buy octopus, and there's, I mean, so this is happening all over. There's, you know, it's funnier than you would imagine. And I think that's going on everywhere, and it's, and again, as the people that were here retreat from this area or die, you know, it's here. It's here. It's waiting, and it's either going to go to us or it's going to go to corn and soybeans. So, I don't know. I'd rather see it go to us.
To us. Well, our time has come to an end. I'm sad. I would love to hear more. I feel like this is just the beginning of a really wonderful discourse, and we didn't even hit most of the other topics that we I want to always give a chance for you to call out to suggest other young farmers some resources or methodologies or books or speakers or ideas for their lives that you would suggest.
Well, I'm going to plug a book written by a friend of mine, and I'm sure other people have plugged it. Maybe you've already talked about it on the show, but Turn Here Sweet Corn by Tina Diffley. And it's memoir, and I'm not a fan of memoir. I usually hate memoir, but she wrote it, and I picked it up, and it's brilliant. She's a friend of ours. She's been a farmer for maybe 40 years or 30-something years, not 40 years, and just a great book about doing what we do, about engaging with the land and the landscape, and growing food for people, and I don't know, I recommend it. It's a great Midwestern book.
Turn Here Sweet Corn. Awesome. Get on your toes, everybody, and register for those winter scholarships, this BFRDP money. We can't take it for granted. Make sure that we use up every little last scholarship that there is. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, certainly. It was nice talking with you. It gave me a chance to stand by the wood stove and warm up.
Yeah, give me a chance to sweep the front porch. Alrighty, talk soon. Bye, everybody.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.